In April, more than 1,100 clothing workers died in Bangladesh when a factory collapsed, the worst disaster in the history of the garment industry. Many survivors lost limbs. Sometimes rescuers were forced to perform amputations without anaesthetic. Last night, Four Corners on the ABC revealed the extent to which Australian companies have flooded into Bangladesh in the past decade to take advantage of lax labour laws and the lowest wages in the world, with some companies squeezing suppliers to keep the prices low. This is not news to Michelle O'Neill. She's the National Secretary of the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union. And 2 days before the collapse of that building in Dhaka, she was meeting with textile unions from Bangladesh, amongst other countries, at a meeting in Singapore. Michelle O'Neill, good morning. Welcome to Breakfast.
Good morning, Fran.
Have Australian retailers changed their practices as a result of the disaster in Dhaka?
Well, shockingly, not many have. We've seen a few Australian companies sign on to this important Bangladesh fire and building safety accord that globally brands are being urged to become a part of. But the majority of Australian companies or companies retailing in Australia selling Bangladesh products haven't signed on.
We don't know how many companies they are. Even Four Corners, with all the efforts they've made, could name, I think it was five, including Coles, including Rivers, including Kmart, including Forever New, which is a retail chain. Some of these companies have now signed on. Big W and Kmart have signed up to the Bangladesh Safety Accord, and Coles has just put out a comment saying that it will sign the Bangladesh Fire and Safety Agreement and does not intend to manufacture any further mixed clothing in Bangladesh. But if it does, it would only source from factories accredited under global ethical sourcing guidelines. So there are some positive moves being made. Forever New, I think, signed up on Friday as well.
Look, I think you have to ask questions of these brands. I'm pleased to hear some of them have responded to last night's story, and a couple had responded in the lead-up. That included Kmart and Target. I'm yet to see the statements that Big W and Coles have released, but you've got to say that there is nothing stopping them having signed this in the past or having signed it since the 24th of April and those 1,127 workers lost their lives. I mean, this is industrial homicide. These are workers, young women mainly, going about their jobs, sitting behind a sewing machine, losing their life, losing their limbs, some injured and scarred in many ways for life. And how can it be that companies like Rivers, companies like those in the Just Group that also manufacture in Bangladesh, in the Specialty Fashion Group, these are Australian companies, brands like Just Jeans, Portman's, Jackie E, Katie's, Miller's, Dottie, how can these companies, Rivers, we know the prices that they advertise their products for. Don't tell me they're ignorant to the conditions that these workers are working in.
Does it come down to it? I mean, it's certainly price, 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 and that's what we heard in the documentary last night on Four Corners. One of the people there who negotiates with companies and factories said it's all about price, and companies are still offering the same prices per garment as they were 10 years ago, which is obviously going to have an effect on the workforce and how they're paid and the conditions they work in. But as consumers too, do we have a responsibility to acknowledge that if something is very cheap for us to buy, it's very, very cheap for the retailers to make, and that's going to have an impact on the workforce?
Look, we have a responsibility, but we've primarily got a responsibility to think about the labour behind the label and to do something about those brands that are making workers work in those unacceptable conditions. This is not an accident. You cannot source from the cheapest places on earth and not be aware that you're not paying enough to ensure that workers are safe, to make sure that they get a living wage, or in fact to be able to give them the capacity to organise themselves into a union.
How much do the retailers know?
These are the things that guarantee safety.
From your experience, do the retailers have, you know, first-hand observation of the factories and the conditions? Do they send people there? Should they bother to send people there? Would that change something?
Of course they know. I mean, this is a deliberate global strategy about distancing themselves from the direct employment relationship, but they still care that they're going to get the actual product that they want. So they do send people to look at whether they're getting the right colour, whether they're getting the right design, sometimes whether they're getting the right quality. But it's not enough to self-regulate. It's not enough for a company A to pay company B to audit their own factory. This is not genuine ethical behaviour. The only assurance that consumers can have is that when manufacturers and retailers are part of genuine multi-stakeholder arrangements, where there's unions involved, where there's civil society organisations involved, where the employers have real and enforceable obligations, and of course where countries introduce real and enforceable laws. And this is not a fix by saying, oh, we'll just check our own factory. It doesn't work, that sort of system.
Is it a fix by signing on to the Bangladesh Fire and Safety Agreement? I mean, the concern for Bangladeshis, I'm sure, is that, you know, they're a poisonous brand now in terms of marketing terms, and that they'll be abandoned for other low-pay countries. These people need these jobs. Can you have a compliant factory and still be cost-effective for the retailers? And does signing this kind of accord and agreement make that happen?
There's a couple of issues in there, Fran. Firstly, signing that accord is a critical first step, but by no means is it the only thing that needs to be done. There needs to be a change in the law in Bangladesh. Workers need to have the right to join a union, the right to have a living wage. You cannot say that $38 US a month, if you're lucky enough to get that as the minimum, is something that you can live on and not live in poverty. But brands also who are selling products made in Bangladesh, and not just cheap brands, many of the brands around the world and in Australia who are selling products here are seeing massive markups. So yes, we have to be careful about cheap products, but look at some of these brands. Look at Gap, for example. Look at G-Star, for example. These are not brands that sell cheap products. Okay. So there is room. There is room to lift the wages and conditions, as well as ensure there's ethical supply. And of course, we have ethical supply here in Australia, where companies are checked, and if they're accredited with ethical Clothing Australia, are making products here that we can be sure are being checked in terms of fair wages and conditions and safety.
Michelle O'Neill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Fran.
Michelle O'Neill is the National Secretary for the Textile, Clothing and Footwear Union, and one of the ongoing issues for those workers and their families who have survived, some of the people killed there, is the income and the lack of income. If you've lost your leg or your arm, you can't work, and there's not much support in Bangladesh. And there's been very little compensation flowing to these people. On that note, on Thursday night at the Melbourne Celtic Club, the union, TCF Union, is organising a fundraiser for the victims of the Bangladesh factory collapse, and also for the Bangladesh Textile Union. And on Life Matters this morning, keep listening, Robbie Buck will be looking at the ethics of buying cheap clothes. Is it right to support retailers who use cheap labour? If you think about it, if you're getting a pair of jeans for $15, no one's paying anyone very much to make them. It's 23 past 8.
You're with Fran Kelly, RN Breakfast.
Let's return to the highly politically charged issue of Australia's 457 visa scheme. The federal government's trying to legislate so that the onus is on Australian businesses to make every effort to employ Australian citizens before they source labour from overseas. A House of Reps vote on the legislation is expected this morning, and the vote will go down to the wire. The government has been struggling to round up the numbers from the crossbenches that it needs. Also due today, a Senate inquiry into these proposed 457 changes. This committee has heard from workers who claim that employers have used the threat of the termination of their visa to exploit them. Another Senate submission came from a group of IR experts at the University of Adelaide Law School. They argue that the 457 visa system does need reform, but the government is not going about it the right way. In particular, they say the scheme would work much better if labour market testing was done independently of employers. Professor Andrew Stewart is a labour law expert at the University of Adelaide. Professor Stewart, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Good morning, Fran.
The Minister, Brendan O'Connor, has alleged in the past that there's 10,000 cases of 457s being rorted. Where do you stand on this argument of the level of abuse? Is it widespread? Is it limited? How urgently is change needed?
Well, I think what my colleagues Joanna Howe, Alex Riley and I would say is that there are probably two types of rorting that we need to be concerned about. One is relatively limited but still very concerning, and that includes or involves having employers bringing in workers who are subject to quite appalling conditions. They're beholden to their employers. They often have to pay a very significant portion of their wage to their employers to be able to stay in the country, and the threat is there if their visa's cancelled that they have to be out of the country within 28 days. Now, a lot of what the government is trying to do in the bill is, we think, quite well directed to dealing with that situation.
Which includes more official visits, more inspections, that kind of thing?
That's exactly right. And also to give the workers themselves more protection, extending from 28 to 90 days the period that they can stay in the country after sponsorship ends. But there's another kind of, rorting may not be the right word for it, but there's another kind of use that quite a large number of employers have come to make of the 457 visa system that we feel needs to be reined in. We think the government's right to be concerned about this. And that is just the explosion in the number of visas that are being granted, and for occupations that very few people in the Australian community would be prepared to agree are in genuine shortage. If you look at the list of skills that are now automatically attract 457 visas, they include flight attendants, singers, radio announcers, pig farmers, glaziers. Just about any profession you can think of is on that list. So,
and it's hard to imagine that you couldn't find people with those skills in Australia.
Well, precisely. So what's happened here is that we've moved from, if you go back to before 1996, employers always had to do labour market testing before they could get someone in. And that was quite a cumbersome process.
Just to decode that, Andrew, labour market testing means having proof that you've actually advertised in Australia for the job, made a real effort to recruit in Australia.
Yeah, that's right. And for employers that take that seriously, that can be very cumbersome, and it can mean real delays in filling much needed skill shortages. On the other hand, for employers that aren't prepared to do the right thing, it can be fairly easily rorted. So the government, the Howard government, moved away from that idea put its faith more in the idea that if a skill was on a list of shortages, then employers could access that without, or could gain 457 visas for workers in those categories without having to do labour market testing. And in fact, since 2001, there's been no labour market testing requirement at all. The trouble is that the number of skills on that list has ballooned. And there's pretty clear evidence now that what a number of employers are doing is bringing workers in because they simply can't be bothered to look for local workers, or they want to find workers who are more compliant, less likely to join unions, or as we see in the IT industry, and there was a very good report on this last week on the 7:30 report on ABC TV, they're looking for workers who'll take less than what is effectively the going rate.
Okay, so all of that constitutes what we might describe as sort of rorting the system. So the government's responding, one of the reforms, and this is the one where you take some issue with how they're designing it, is to insist on labour market testing over a six-month period. Business doesn't like that because it is red tape. As you say, it slows them down when they might need to recruit quickly. Is the issue that this list, this automatic list, is way too broad? If we focused on streamlining that list and really pinpointing where the skill shortages clearly are in this country, and then you could still have that streamlined process so you didn't have to labour market test if it really was a genuine list of where we need skills.
That's exactly right, and it's that what we've advocated, and in fact what the government seems to have accepted in principle, is a two-track or a two-stream approach where for the higher skilled occupations, if they're on a list that's been independently compiled, and we suggest using the Australian Workplace and Productivity Agency to do this, if it's on that list as being certified independently, as being genuinely in shortage, employers can still quickly access visas in those categories. For lower skilled jobs, the kind of jobs that are routinely now attracting 457 visas and really shouldn't be, then for those employers would have to go through a rigorous process of labour market testing. The government effectively has adopted that because it's said that the new labour market testing requirement that it's proposing won't apply to the very highest skill levels. We just think it's a question of getting the balance right between those two approaches.
And what do you think the balance would be? How long do you think the list would be if we really had an independent review of where the skill shortages, the speed humps, if you like, are in this country? How many, in an optimum world, how many skills would we have on that list that would give automatic right to recruit under 457 visa?
What's interesting that if you look at the list for people who are seeking permanent migration, that list is something somewhere in the region of 150 to 200 I think, jobs, whereas there are well over 600 on the list that's currently being used for 457 visas. We'd certainly expect that it would come down, and we expect that it would be skewed much more to the really highly skilled areas, because one other issue that we have got to face up to in this country, and again, the government's acknowledged this in other contexts, is the need to encourage business to recommit to training and investment in skills. For many businesses, and it's understandable, it's a quick fix to look overseas for a highly trained, highly experienced worker who you can bring in perhaps more cheaply than it is to train up somebody locally. We need to get back to the idea of encouraging skills acquisition here in Australia.
So just very briefly, Andrew, as the legislation stands, and it will be voted on today and perhaps tomorrow, should the reforms be passed, but should the government be making the changes, as you suggest, before written into this legislation, or can it be safely done afterwards?
Well, to some extent, because of the way the legislation's drafted, there's a considerable amount of discretion that's given to the way in which regulations are put forward. So we do think this legislation's a positive step. It ought to be passed. It would be better if it could be reoriented either right now or through the use of appropriate regulations more to the, down the route that we've suggested.
Andrew Stewart, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Brent.
Professor Andrew Stewart, he's a Labor and Migration Lawyer at the University of Adelaide Law School, and put in a submission to the Senate inquiry. That inquiry reports today.